Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Degin Adour, one of the hosts of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Levy about his new book, Sokagakai's Human Revolution, The Rise of a Mimetic Nation in Modern Japan, published by the University of Hawaii Press in 2019. Levy, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Dainaya. It's a delight. It's a delight to talk to you.
Great. So Levy, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself. How did you become interested in East Asian studies and specifically in Japan?
Okay, well, I was born and raised in Toronto, Canada, and actually turned to the study of Japan just as I entered university. In my high school years and before that, I was training very seriously in music, mostly focusing on violin. And then I made a rather abrupt change at 18 to not pursue a professional career and instead see basically how far I could get from Toronto. And Japan looked pretty far. I mean, there are other factors as well that were at play. I was enamored at that point of novels by Japanese authors that had been translated into English. So I was reading the works of people who are now considered a little old-fashioned, but were, to me, new. Like Abe Kobo and Tanizaki Junichiro, Kawabata Yasunari. So I was enamored of this really romantic vision of Japan, and I thought it'd be really cool to read Japanese and go to Japan and things like that. So I ended up becoming a Japanese studies major at the University of Toronto. I did a third year abroad. This is how old I am. This was before the Hanshin disaster that affected Kobe. I was in Western Japan at Kansai Gakuin University in 1993-94. And that's actually where I first became interested in religion. I was fortunate to take a course from an emeritus professor there who was a wonderful guy named Sakai Sensei, who took us around to different religious sites. And initially we visited very, very old places like Asuka, you know, outside of Nara, so the very oldest forms of Japanese Buddhism and things like that. Then on a second trip, we went to visit what were called Shinshukyo, new religions. And so we visited various sites. But one place we did not visit was Sokagakai. And we were warned essentially at that point that Sokagakai was this sort of large, yet somewhat unapproachable organization. And I was intrigued by this. I was intrigued by the fact that there's this giant elephant in the room, basically, for Japanese religion. You know, I sort of had this sort of like sort of contrarian desire to look at the thing that was supposed to be taboo, and that's where that started initially. And so eventually, I made my way back to Japan as a teacher initially, but then also I became a student at the University of Tokyo for 2 years from the year 2000, and that's where I was able to really begin in earnest with field work with Sokagakai members. That's what's continued to the present. So at this point, I've spent something almost 2 decades as a non-member ethnographic researcher within the organization.
Well, great. Thank you for sharing that with us. So maybe tell us a little bit how you came to write Sokagakai's Human Revolution.
Sure. Well, the book is a much revised version of a dissertation that I produced at Princeton University under the tutelage of Jacqueline Stone. It's a product of many years spent within the group. Basically, I was inspired to write a book that answered some basic questions about Soka Gakkai, but also more generally about groups that are labeled as sort of controversial or so-called new religions. One of the big questions that's hung over Soka Gakkai for many years is, why did it get so big? So the group is unusual in a lot of respects. For one thing, the name, Soka Gakkai, it's a Value Creation Study Association, which you have to admit is kind of an odd name for religion, right? And that's because it didn't start as a religion at all. It began as an educational reform movement. It was founded by school teachers and intellectuals in the turn of the 20th century who were inspired by neo-Kantian philosophy, John Dewey, others who were pushing forward with new ways of belonging to the nation in proactive and constructive ways. They converted to a form of Buddhism called Nichiren Buddhism. Nichiren was a medieval reformer in Japan who held that only the final teaching of the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni, that is the Lotus Sutra, is an efficacious way to receive salvation in our age, which is the latter day of the Buddhist law. The initial founders of the Gakkai, a teacher named Makiguchi and his disciple named Toda, converted and became hardcore proselytizers and utterly unwilling to compromise in their singular beliefs and their singular upholding of the lotus, and willing to suffer the consequences of state persecution. So they were active during the wartime years in Japan, and under the wartime government, all religions were required to enshrine talismans for the sun goddess, the ancestress of the emperor. They refused to do so and were imprisoned. Makiguchi died of malnutrition in prison during the war. Toda emerges from the wartime imprisonment just before the end of the Pacific War in July of 1945 and transforms this group that began as an educational reform movement into this massive religious organization, and it grew by unbelievable leaps and bounds. So in the early 1950s, there were several thousand members, and by the end of the 1950s, there were about 1 million households that were adherents in Japan of Soka Gakkai. His successor, Ikeda Daisaku, who is now the absolute authority in all matters within Soka Gakkai, took over as third president in 1960, and under Ikeda's auspices, Soka Gakkai grows to be a massive phenomenon, utterly beyond anything that any other group in Japan, and becomes Japan's most successful religious export. So just in terms of sheer numbers of adherents, there are more members of Soka Gakkai than there are basically of other Japanese groups. And so the big question was, why? Why this group? Why? What accounts for this? What accounts for the particular success in gaining converts? But also, why does Soka Gakkai look the way it does? Why does it have an affiliated political party? It's actually most famous in Japan for being associated with a party called Kolmento, the Clean Government Party, as it's sometimes called, which is part of Japan's ruling coalition. Why do Soka Gakkai members focus on a newspaper? Why do they have schools, like a university and other kinds of schools? Members carry out a form of taxation, where they give on an annual basis to the organization and other times as well. They have a huge corpus of publications that essentially functions as a national literature. And so I wanted to provide an answer for the why, and the answer for me was, it's in the title of the book, The Rise of a Mimetic Nation. I really conceive of Soka Gakkai as mimetic of Japan as a modern nation state. It basically took the very nation state that victimized its founders and transformed it into this utopian ideal. And that accounts for the singular appeal of a different form of national belonging that Soka Gakkai offers its adherents, as well as explaining the particular nature of its constituent institutions.
Oh, great. These are really interesting questions that you're investigating. And actually, before we go into this mimetic nation metaphor, I have a question about the twin legacies that you mentioned in the preface.
Right.
So you argue that Soka Gakkai comprises a great deal more than Buddhism and is instead best conceived as a product of twin legacies.
Yeah.
So between lay Nichiren Buddhism and modern Euro-American humanist imports. So what does this say about the place of Soka Gakkai in the landscape of Japanese religions?
Yeah, I think that's a really important way to understand, first of all, it's the sort of this distinctive nature of the institutions and also the dispositions that members have. And it also accounts for, I think, another reason why it became so distinctly popular. So when you spend time in the Soka Gakkai family, or if you spend time engaging with Soka Gakkai activities, much of your time will not actually look very Buddhist on the outside. Certainly, there's a strict adherence to Nichiren Buddhist practices, chanting the Lotus Sutra, most specifically chanting the seven syllables of the sacred title of the lotus in what's called the Daimoku, which is the syllables Nam-myoho-renge-kyo. There is a reverence for an object of worship called the Gohonzon, which is a replica of a calligraphic mandala that was inscribed by Nichiren in 1279. And then there's, of course, reverence for Nichiren's writings, which are known as the Gosho, and for the lotus itself. However, I spent most of my time, probably because I was, trained so intensely as a musician, playing music with Soka Gakkai members. I joined a symphony orchestra that was run by the Young Men's Division, and we almost exclusively played Beethoven. Beethoven is considered to be this revolutionary figure. He's a major figure in Japan generally. But within Soka Gakkai, he takes on a kind of apotheosized image. And for these members, playing Beethoven was just as religious an activity as chanting the Lotus Sutra is. And so there was no distinction. So what does this allow? This means that all the kind of humanistic pursuits that you might want to be to go after, including vocational stuff like doing well in your job, no matter what your job might be, can take on a sacred significance that can be accommodated by these legacies that formulated Soka Gakkai at its inception.
All right, great. Thank you for the answer. And the subtitle of the book, The Rise of a Mimetic Nation in Modern Japan, is really interesting. So you characterize Soka Gakkai as a mimetic of the nation state in which it took place. Can you tell us more about this idea?
Yeah, so in an earlier sort of working out of these ideas, I had characterized Soka Gakkai as an adjunct nation, as something that looks an awful lot like a nation state, but is kind of like attached to the main nation state. And through discussions with a lot of, really fine thinkers, including Prasenjit Duwara and a few others, realized mimesis is a far more provocative and more satisfying explanation for what's going on. For one thing, it's actually it's about process rather than describing a phenomenon. So as far as I could see, we need to understand how the things develop and continue to develop. And so I was inspired particularly by the thought of René Girard in this regard about mimetic violence and the notion of mimesis, of imitation as not simply as simple-mindedly copying something, but as rendering something into an ideal. And also, just by virtue of reproducing something, of creating an alternative authority, of actually creating a competitive version of something that bears authority. And so this offers another explanatory power. So Soka Gakkai is widely maligned in Japan and actually elsewhere as well. It earned a very negative reputation for the actions of its adherents, particularly in its high growth phase of the 50s into the 70s. I hear stories now, more and more actually, of people who are reflecting back on that time, where Gakkai members, for example, would stand in the doorway of adherents of rival religions from morning till night, chastising them for belonging to what was called a jashu, or like false sects, and urging them to convert instead to Soka Gakkai. I mean, this was obnoxious behavior, it has to be said, but it works. And so it brought people in. And through this, they built all these constituent institutions, things like a political party, the working equivalent of sovereign territory that was protected by cadres of young men who kind of have a de facto military or police role, all kinds of things like that. But by virtue of creating something that looks an awful lot like the state, people, especially government officials, start to regard Soka Gakkai as an intimate threat. It's too close to the thing it's imitating, and therefore is, in a way, terrifying. It's existentially terrifying. And so the, I would say, disproportionately panicked reaction against Soka Gakkai that you see on the part of its religious and political rivals can be explained through this notion of mimesis, that because it's this rival for something, it's perceived as a rival for something, it triggers a disproportionately violent reaction.
Well, this is a really refreshing perspective. And like you mentioned in the preface, you also anticipate limits for the mimetic nation metaphor.
Well, it's a metaphor, right? It's not a checklist for political scientists to go down and say, oh, wait, you're missing this factor and that factor. Yeah, it's meant to be an inspirational model. And so, I mean, one of the things I struggled with as I was doing this analysis is also the in the literature itself on the nation or nation states, nation and state blur. I mean, there are times where something might look like a nation rather than a state, or vice versa. And there's also really important work by people like Timothy Mitchell and others on the sort of the discursive elements, the way that actually the state kind of precedes itself as an idea. And so he calls it a state effect. And I really see that happening in Soka Gakkai as well. It's through, by virtue of the actions and even the attitudes of its members, it creates the image of the power of the institution that may not even connect to the practical realities of what's going on. And so there's this sort of, you're just sort of expected to go along with things because they look like they bear authority. And that has powered a lot of the way that Soka Gakkai has grown, and also powers a lot of the way that members respond to injunctions from the administration. And so there's an expectation that you're supposed to just sort of continue to shoulder the institutional mandates as personal goals. And there may not be like direct orders to each individual person to do so, but they sort of are cultivated to take these on and rewarded for doing so. And I think that can be compared to this notion of a kind of an effect of the institution itself, and how that aesthetic guides the way that ordinary members are cultivate themselves as disciples within the group.
All right, thank you. And now let's get into the chapters.
Sure.
Chapter 2, From an Intellectual Collective to Religion, you explore the history of Soka Gakkai. So
yes.
How has the organization developed from a small educational reform society into a massive religion?
I one thing that I never get sick of looking at Soka Gakkai's history. I think it's one of the most amazing stories of really any organization anywhere, religious or otherwise. It begins it's founded by this, as I mentioned earlier, Makiguchi Tsune Saburo, who's this sort of petty bourgeois school teacher who makes his way to the imperial capital of Tokyo from the northern island of Hokkaido. He's inspired to join what was then a thriving intellectual climate. But by virtue of not belonging to the upper echelons, the social classes that would give him sort of unfettered access to those intellectual circles, he's always sort of an outsider. And I think that experience translates into subsequent generations. Soka Gakkai grows a reputation, especially in the post-war years, kind of a sneeringly referred to as a religion of the poor. And indeed, in its high growth phase, it largely attracted people who had been marginalized socially by virtue of having been cut out from the access to education, having been women, having been ill, having had their childhoods robbed from them during the wartime years. And so there's a sense of, I would say, just like this aspirational urge on the part of its of the people who really built the group to respond to having been cut out of what Bourdieu refers to as social capital, right? They're not able to sort of like enter into the power circles. Japan is a place where a lot of people will self-identify as being middle class. And in surveys until recently, something like 90% of people self-identified as being middle class. And that's total crap. It's completely not. It's a very socially striated place. And there are lots and lots of people who fell through the cracks during Japan's rise as in what was called the economic miracle in the post-war economic development phase. Those people tend to be the types who joined Sokugankai in those years. They don't sit idle. They build the institutions that are going to give them social legitimacy. They build museums. They build universities. They build schools. They take part in musical activities. They write literature. They read literature. They become extraordinarily adept at understanding all of these things. And the subsequent generations, like the kids now, who are now third and fourth generation, I think of them as kind of like a corollary to the immigrant phenomenon, you know, so that their parents were hardworking and poor, but they don't suffer, the kids don't suffer the same kind of material want, and also they don't have the same kind of aspirations as their parents because they haven't experienced the same kinds of hardships. And so now Sokugankai is kind of in this weird moment of an existential crisis. It's in a funny way, kind of a victim of its own success. The kids who are going to be taking the group into the 21st century, who are going to be perpetuating it past the lifetime of its current charismatic leader, Ikeda Daisaku, do not have the same sense of urgency that their parents and grandparents had. So that creates this really existential dilemma for the group. And I think that can only really be understood by the history that I outline in that chapter, which talks about that development from this sort of like petty bourgeois educational reform thing into this enormous sort of millennial religious movement.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, it's certainly a really incredible story. And chapter 3, Sokugankai's dramatic narrative, investigates ways Gakkai media and their attendant practices conflates Nichiren Buddhism, martyrdom, and modern romantic heroism in a dramatic narrative that relies on tropes from the Japanese educational curriculum. So what are these dramatic narratives?
Yeah, this is where the twin legacies start to really matter. So Nichiren is this really distinctive figure in I would say, just religious history, and it's specifically in Japanese Buddhist history. If you look at the layout of Japanese religious, Japanese Buddhist sects, it's the only one named for its founder, really, the only major one at least. And there's a reason for that, because there's really nothing quite like Nietzsche then. So he's born in 1222. He becomes, like all Buddhist monks of his time, a follower of the Tendai sect. But he comes into sort of conflict with the teachings there and breaks off on his own and develops a reputation for being absolutely uncompromising, willing to hold the line on his conviction that the only way for the people of Japan to realize salvation in this degraded age is to exclusively uphold the Lotus Sutra. And he remonstrates the government of his time. He's exiled twice. The government attempts to execute him once. He dies at the age of 60, which in his era was a fairly advanced age, but he nonetheless sort of created a model of martyrdom, of this willingly giving up his life for the sake of the mission. And so since in the centuries after Nichiren's lifetime, there's been this whole series of Nichiren Buddhist groups that are led by clerics, but also by lay people. People who basically take Nichiren's biography as a model for their own lives. And generally, this includes some form of confronting governmental authority. And there's something that really, it seems like in the 20th century in particular, there's a resonance between Nichiren's single-minded, uncompromising approach to life and the attitudes that took shape in the modern era. And there's just something about that is very inspiring. So a lot of the largest groups in Japan that emerged around that time, not just Soka Gakkai, but Risho Kosekai, Reiyukai, and some others, are Nichiren Buddhism based. And so that's one of the inspirations for the dramatic narrative. As Soka Gakkai emerges from its standardized education basis, it also has other revolutionary influences. These largely come via literature. And so early in its post-war growth phase, the young men's division in particular are being trained by Toda in a curriculum of novels. And the novels include things like The Count of Monte Cristo. Count of Monte Cristo serves essentially as a model for Soka Gakkai's own novelized history of its past in a novel, in a serial novel called Ningen Kakume, or The Human Revolution, which of course also inspires the title for my own book, because I really think this is, you must understand the Human Revolution to understand Soka Gakkai, and this is something that every member will tell you as well. The Human Revolution serves essentially as Soka Gakkai's sacred text. It becomes the core of its own canon. And throughout the book, I play with this idea of canonization, of what does it mean to create a canon? What does it mean to be part of canon creation yourself? I think there's something distinctive about that. That comes up in the chapter following the dramatic narrative chapter. In the dramatic narrative chapter, I do a close reading of one of the chapters of The Human Revolution to look at ways in which the Nichiren Buddhism conflates with the modern heroic, romantic, revolutionary ideas that come from a host of influences, including world literature.
Oh, great. And just continuing our conversation on dramatic narratives in Soka Gakkai, as a new religion, Soka Gakkai creates new texts, yes, such as Ikeda Daisaku's The Human Revolution, the text that you've been just talking about. So what are some of the distinctive features of this new canon as discussed in chapter 4 of the book?
Right. I have this idea, which I hope is applicable beyond Soka Gakkai. By the way, I think all of these ideas are not unique at all to Soka Gakkai. I think Soka Gakkai, I don't treat it so much as a case study, but I think that people who read this book who are otherwise engaged in studying religion, politics, literature, can find parallels that I hope will be useful elsewhere. And one of those is this notion of canon creation. I call it the participatory canon. So there's a lot of new religion scholarship, and one of the topics is taken up in the so-called what makes a new religion new, right? That's sort of a perennial question for those people who look at religions that are founded in the modern era. And there's considerable debate about this because most of the time, for one thing, new religions don't like to be called new religions, and Soka Gakkai is included in that. It calls itself a Dento Taru Shukyo, which is like a traditional traditional religion, and it holds to be like an inheritor of the Dharma via Nichiren, who was understood to be the eternal Buddha. So it's actually the oldest teaching. Nonetheless, it's chronologically new, comparatively speaking. So it offers its adherents possibilities that aren't available to followers of old religions. And one of those things is for you as a believer to personally belong to Scripture. What does that mean? It means that something like the Human Revolution and its sequel, which is a just completed 30-volume, massive work called The New Human Revolution, includes all of these stories. And there are lots of stories about ordinary members, all of whom have been anonymized. Nonetheless, they're identifiable to those who know who they are. And so the stories are about these upstanding, virtuous people, and in a few cases also cautionary tales. The idea is that should you be sufficiently virtuous and should your life intersect with that of the honorary president Ikeda Daisaku, you can appear in a serialized romantic novel that your fellow adherents treat as scripture. Now, you can then be memorialized long after your death in something that works as canon. That's a really alluring, really exciting possibility. It's not to say, so if you're a Christian, for example, or if you're a follower of a Buddhist sect, you can't appear yourself in a sacred text. You can say you can identify, say, metaphorically with the people who appear in those older texts, but you won't actually be that person. The new religion offers the possibility for you to actually be that person. And I think that might be one possible answer to what makes a new religion new. And it also answers the questions, why would someone join a group that is otherwise maligned, right? So Soka Gakkai has largely a very negative public image. It's considered to be a source of stigma. If you are a Gakkai member, you are essentially you run the risk of being ostracized. You might have difficulty getting a job or even an apartment, that kind of thing. If you are known to be a Gakkai member, these are the kinds of experiences that are quite common for Gakkai adherents in Japan. So why would you join? Why would you join a group like that? And why would you stay in a group like that? Well, one possibility might be that you are part of this mission and you will be memorialized within it in ways that aren't possible if you are part of an older group. That's what I propose, that participatory canon idea. Yeah.
That's really interesting. It's certainly a really powerful allure, right, to include yourself in the new canon for tradition. And speaking of membership, so in Chapter 5, Cultivating Youth, you explore religion as pedagogy and discipleship in Soka Gakkai through the standardized education. Can you tell us more about what this socialization process entails?
Yeah, so by virtue of just spending so long with members and being so persistent, I was able to take part as a non-member in a lot of things that I don't think non-members ordinarily take part in. So I should be really clear about my methodology too. I was always very, very upfront about who I was and what I was doing. I never misrepresented myself. I was like, I am a non-member, but I'm keenly interested. And I think that what's most important for people to know about in a group like Soka Gakkai, and in Soka Gakkai specifically, is the humanity of the everyday lives of people. Like people can understand these sort of the intimate realities of ordinary members, I think that they'll be more sympathetic to them. And I really do believe that to be the case. And so by virtue of that, I got to know people over many years. And one of the things I was able to do was study for and take what was known as the Ningyong Shikeng. Or is still known as. It's the Ningyo Shikeng it translated literally means appointment examination, which sounds like something for the civil service, which again, I think speaks to this mimetic nation idea. But what it is, it's an introductory doctrinal examination. And it's understood that if you're in the youth divisions, the young men's or the young women's divisions, you're encouraged to take this exam, study for basically Buddhist terminology, learning about Nichiren, learning about Soka Gakkai's history, and very specifically also learning about Soka Gakkai's opposition to its now former Buddhist temple parent, Nichiren Shoshu. So it's a way to sort of like cultivate loyalty and education within the youth. And so what I learned is basically that the exam is not the test. The test comes from dedicating yourself to the study regimen and immersing yourself in this cycle of campaigns that makes up life in Soka Gakkai. So Buddhist groups, or religious groups generally in Japan, are known to have what's called a Nenchu Gyoji, or an annual cycle of rituals. So if you go to a shrine, a Shinto shrine, you'll see often a list on a placard of all the different rituals that make up the annual cycle. You'll see the same thing at Buddhist temples. Soka Gakkai has essentially made up its own cycle of events, of campaigns. And one of those things is an annual or biannual cycle of examinations, which are modeled on school exams. So the format was precisely that for sort of the entrance examinations for a school. And it was all this terminology related to Nichiren Buddhism. And so it's also, a way of really fostering or really solidifying discipleship. And there's been an increasing focus in Soka Gakkai on this concept of what's called Shite Funi, or the indivisible union of master and disciple, mentor and disciple. So all members are understood to be affectively one-to-one direct disciples with Avikira Daisaku. And so how do you, in a pragmatic term, way, how do you cultivate that? Well, it turns out you cultivate that through study programs of this nature as a major way to do this kind of thing. So I was able to undertake that, and the chapter goes through that immersion process and looks at ways in which these texts are imbued into the lives of ordinary members as a result.
Great, thank you. And more specifically on female members of the organization, is chapter 6 is dedicated to the discussion on that. So chapter 6, Good Wives, Wise Mothers, and Foot Soldiers of Conversion, you observe a tension between, on the one hand, Soka Gakkai's ideal of women as wife, mother, and cultivator of the home, and on the other hand, the Gakkai administration's demand on its married women's division to be active outside of the home. So how does Soka Gakkai members, especially female members, negotiate this tension?
Yeah, this is, I think, the crux of the matter. In the initial drafts of the book, I was actually struggling with how to talk about gender generally. I think because ideally gender should be this core, this thread that runs through the entire thing. And I think it does. Throughout the book, women are actually front and center as the main people I try to focus on. I've noticed there's a tendency in a lot of books on religion to have the woman chapter, and it's almost always the last chapter. And I was trying to avoid that. But as it turns out, it was also the culmination of the book. So I think it worked in the arrangement that I have. Here, too, this is where Soka Gakkai is by no means unique, right? Where women in patriarchal, unequal power relationships engage in strategic means of realizing their own subjectivity and of articulating themselves within these hierarchical organizations in ways that move well beyond what it looks like on paper. So Soka Gakkai, even by Japan's frankly misogynist standards, is a really conservative organization. There's this massive bureaucratic hierarchy, the working equivalent of a civil service, which has hundreds of vice presidents, not one of whom is a woman. If you are a woman in the what's called the yakushoku, if you have like official duties, official post of some sort, salaried or otherwise, in the organization, if you're a woman, the only way upwards through the hierarchy is via the young women's or married women's divisions. There are a few posts at the local level in which women exert a great deal of influence, but they can't become senior executives, basically. So it looks like they're really limited. But the truth is that the Fujinbu, which is the married women's division, is the absolute engine, is the power center of Soka Gakkai. And if the Fujinbu went on strike, Soka Gakkai would disappear overnight. And so the chapter essentially identifies the paradoxes of that situation, and especially the incommensurate demands that are placed on these women who are, on the one hand, understood to have this duty of cultivating themselves in what's known as a Ryosai Kenbo, as the good wife, wise mother. This was a feminine ideal that was promoted in particular from the Meiji era in Japan. That is, like, when Japan transformed into a modern imperial polity, where women were required essentially to become the cultivators of the home front, to create human resources who would go on to perpetuate Japan as an expansive empire. Sokagaka has the working equivalent of that, with the women in the home building the next generation. At the same time, these same women are called upon to take part in extensive campaigns that bring them out of the house. So, for example, electoral campaigns for Kolmeito, the political party, and its political allies. Who's on the front lines for all of these things? It's the Fujinbu, it's the Married Women's Division. And so the women are torn between these rival objectives. And it has difficult effects on them, on their families, and on their children as well. And so I through a number of what I think are fairly vivid case studies, sort of like ethnographic episodes, vignettes, I talk about ways in which these unresolved tensions play out in the lives of women adherents. And I end with a description, a long conversation with a woman who runs against a lot of these ideals. So I call her Miho in the chapter. All the names, by the way, are pseudonyms, of course. So Miho came from an abusive household, Sokagakkai household, in which she was basically accused of not being worthy of Sokagakkai mission and encouraged to kill herself, in which she attempted suicide. And thereafter entered into a very long period of depression, just a debilitating depression, essentially becoming what is known in Japan as hikikomori, or sort of like a shut-in, refusing to leave the house. So I met her kind of at the end of a 10-year period of that really terrible state. And she pulled herself out of that state by turning to Sokagakkai's teachings. So Sokagakkai's, especially Ikeda's teachings, were simultaneously the weapon used against her and the way she pulled herself out of that. And so she does not conform in any conceivable way to this kind of like married woman's ideal. And yet she is this really sort of exemplary disciple. And so she kind of rounds out the book in a way, as kind of like where Sokagakkai is going forward, as this, having had this rich, complicated legacy based on collective activity, and now increasingly having to appeal to a generation that is seeking individual means of navigating their lives going forward in the post-Ikeda era.
Well, these are really interesting kind of reflections and insights that you're offering with us. And lastly, in the afterwards, concluding remarks of the book, you highlighted the dilemma that confronts Sokagakkai as it seeks to appeal to a new generation of members who are driven by aspirations that are not necessarily accommodated by the organization. So what implications might this have on the future development of the organization?
That's the big mystery. that's the question that a lot of people are facing right now. Where is Sokagakkai going to go in the future? I'm in Japan right now. I'm fortunate to have received a fellowship that has taken me back into the field where I've spent most of this past year. Once again, actually for the first time in a while, spending months at a time with Gakkai members. And I'm hearing things now that I haven't heard in my 20 years with the group. Really like eyebrow-raising stuff. So members are now telling me things like, we don't think Sokagakkai is going to exist in 20 years. We think there's going to be these massive schisms that are going to render the group into a whole bunch of different things. We think Kolmeito is going to disappear in 10 years because there's no doctrinal or personal motivation to support this electioneering for this party within Sokagakkai after Ikeda Daisaku's lifetime. And also just this kind of a general, as I mentioned earlier, this kind of generational shift that's not exclusive to Sokagakkai by any means, but you see in Japan, where younger people have a whole set, they are far more socially progressive. They are by no means inspired to reproduce the gendered social expectations of their parents and grandparents. It's really hard for me to imagine why a young woman, for example, would want to just cohere with the married women's division's ideals going forward. That I think they're going to so it's going to be a real sort of testing ground for the group. And of course, the big testing ground will be if it can move from charismatic leadership to a routinized form of administration-led religious authority. So that's essentially what Sokagakai kambu or administrators have been trying to do now for decades, which is trying to basically ease the transition away from direct access to Ikeda as their mentor to memorializing Ikeda and the other two founding presidents and moving forward instead following the directives of office holders. The administrative president and those who fall under him in Sokagakai's elaborate hierarchy. That's going to be the big question as to how successful that is.
All right, thank you. Well, Levy, we've taken up a lot of your time, and thank you so much for sharing your incredible research with us. But before we conclude our interview, could you tell us a bit about your current research projects? What are you working on right now?
Sure. I'm planning a second book that moves out of this, but into out of my Gakkai focus into a much more sort of expansive view. I'm planning to write a book on religious dimensions of Japanese politics. And so right now, as I mentioned, I'm back in Japan. Part of that is sort of reigniting my Gakkai research, but I'm also moving into new territory where I'm spending a lot of time with Shinto activists or Shinto organizations. I'm spending time with nationalist groups that are either themselves religions or, as my colleague Julian Thomas calls it, religion-adjacent groups. And these are largely affiliated with an organization that has received a lot of attention called Nippon Kaigi, or the Japan Conference, which has the ear of the Prime Minister, Abe Shinzo. And so my plan is essentially to write a book that will function, that'll be jargon-free, accessible, basically a map of religious aspects of Japanese politics, and will stress the very important fact that if you want to understand politics in Japan, you have to understand religion.
Wow, that sounds like a really great project. We will certainly be looking forward to it. I'm sure our listeners will too. And finally, I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed reading your book. It was incredible.
Hey, I appreciate that so much. Buy two copies. No, I'm just kidding. Enjoy your
All right. Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay, take care.
Right.